Okay, so I want you to imagine for a second that you're standing right in front of a mirror. You see your face, your expressions. Maybe you notice that you look a little tired or a little excited. That part is easy. But now imagine that you turn away from that mirror. You walk over to a window and you look out at the street, the trees, the traffic, the sky. And imagine that somehow you are actually still looking in a mirror.
Wow. Okay, that is quite the psychedelic image to start us off with.
It really is mind-bending, right? But that is the actual core premise we are tackling in today's deep dive. What if the universe isn't this cold, hard, objective thing just sitting out there? What if the way the world works is exactly the same as how we work? What if reality is actually just a reflection of our own internal psychology?
Yeah, you are diving straight into the deep end of what we call post-Hegelian idealism. And it's a really fascinating period in the history of philosophy because it marks this massive pivot. I mean, before this, you had thinkers like Hegel who looked at the world and saw a completely rational, logical system, kind of like a giant math equation solving itself, if you will.
Right, the whole famous the real is rational idea.
Exactly. Hegel believed that history, nature, everything was a logical process. But the sources we have today, which specifically center around a really comprehensive lecture by Dr. Arthur Holmes on the history of philosophy, show us what happened when philosophers just stopped looking for logic and started looking at human experience, specifically the human will.
And that leads us to two very different and honestly very intense ways of seeing reality. On one side, we have Arthur Schopenhauer, who I am gathering is sort of the bad boy of this deep dive. He looks in the mirror and he sees this blind, chaotic, striving
He
force.
certainly does. Schopenhauer presents a universe that is essentially just a giant impulsive urge.
But then just when we think it is all doom and gloom, we're going to pivot over to America, specifically to the campuses of USC and Boston University, to look at this movement called personal idealism.
Which is really the flip side of the coin. They look in the mirror and they see personality, consciousness, and society. They see a universe made up of distinct minds, including a very personal God.
So our mission today for you listening is to figure out, are we living in a world of blind chaos or a world of meaningful connection? And honestly, the answer seems to depend entirely on what we find when we look inside ourselves.
That is the very core of the idealist movement that Dr. Holmes describes in his lecture. It is the attempt to project onto the whole of reality what one sees in the lens or the mirror of one's own human spirit.
So let's start with that lens. Dr. Holmes mentions that after Immanuel Kant, everyone was trying to figure out what reality really was at its base. Hegel said it was reason. But Schopenhauer steps up and says, hold on, look a little closer.
Right, Schopenhauer is what we call a voluntaristic idealist.
Which is quite a mouthful.
It is, yeah, but it's really just a fancy way of saying he believes the fundamental nature of the universe is will, volition rather than intellect or reason.
So if Hegel thinks the universe is like a perfectly organized library where everything is filed alphabetically.
Schopenhauer thinks the universe is a mosh pit or a hungry beast.
That is a very vivid image. But why the massive shift? Like, why did he think Hegel got it so wrong?
Well, because Hegel believed that if you understood your own conscious dialectic, your logical thinking, then you understood the universe. Schopenhauer looked inside and said, sure, I think. But beneath the thinking, there is wanting, there is craving, there is drive. He argues that the intellect is actually just a servant to the will. You don't want a sandwich because you mathematically calculated its nutritional value.
Right, you calculate the nutritional value because you are hungry and you want the sandwich.
Precisely. The urge comes first, the
Yeah.
logic comes later just to justify it. And he concludes that if that is the core of me, that must be the core of everything. Will is reality, and reality is will.
This brings us to his magnum opus, a book with the incredible title, The World as Will and Idea. Or I think it's sometimes translated as The World as Will and Representation.
Yes, and this is where we have to be really careful because Schopenhauer splits the world into two distinct layers. And understanding this split is the absolute key to his whole worldview.
The two worlds theory. Okay, let's break it down. First, there is the world as idea.
This is the world as it appears to us. It is the phenomenal world. When we look around, we see tables, chairs, planets, atoms. We see cause and effect. We see logic.
And Dr. Holmes lists these categories that Schopenhauer talks about called the fourfold root of sufficient reason, which, by the way, sounds exactly like a spell from a fantasy novel.
It really does have a ring to it, but it is actually very systematic. Schopenhauer is saying we impose four types of order on the world just to make it understandable to our brains. We aren't seeing the world naked. We are seeing it through these four lenses.
Okay, walk us through the four lenses.
Sure. First, we have logic, which is ground and consequent. That is how we reason through things. Second, we have physics, which is cause and effect. That is how we understand physical events happening around us. Third, we have mathematics, which covers space and time. Because we literally cannot imagine an object without placing it somewhere in space and time. And fourth is morality, which is motive and action.
So science, math, logic, these aren't the actual bedrock of reality.
No, not to Schopenhauer. To him, they are symbols. They are the mask we put on the world so we can navigate it safely. He calls it Vorstellung, or representation. It is like a map. A map is very useful. It has lines and grids, but the map is obviously not the territory itself.
That is such a crucial distinction, because we get so caught up thinking science describes the thing in itself, but he is saying science really just describes the mask.
Exactly. And this leads to the big problem. If science and logic are just the mask, how do we see what is behind the mask? How do we get to the world as will?
Right, because if I look at a rock, I just see the idea of a rock. I see its shape and its color. I don't see its soul, for lack of a better word.
This Schopenhauer's brilliant and honestly somewhat terrifying insight. He says if we were just winged cherubs without a body, you know, pure floating intellects, we would never, ever know the truth. We would just stare at the mask forever.
But we aren't cherubs. We have actual physical bodies.
Yes, we have what phenomenology calls the lived body. You don't just observe your hand moving the way you observe a car driving down the street. You live the movement.
I feel the urge to move my hand and it just moves. There is no gap there.
Exactly. You experience your body in two ways simultaneously. From the outside, it is an object, an idea. It takes up space. It follows the laws of gravity. But from the inside, immediately, you experience it as will, desire, movement, craving.
So my internal experience of I want or I move is the only time I actually touch true reality.
That is the loophole.
Yeah.
That is the secret passage he finds. And Schopenhauer takes that internal experience and expands it to everything. He says that the inside of me is will, then the inside of that tree, that rock, that star is also will.
But wait, hold on. He is not saying the rock is sitting there thinking about its future, right?
No. And that is where we reach the scary conclusion.
Yeah.
He argues that the will in itself is totally groundless. It is completely outside of time and space. It is outside of cause and effect. It is just a singular, absolute, blind, striving force.
So the universe isn't a clockwork mechanism ticking away. It really is a hungry beast.
It is endless energy, endless creativity, but with absolutely no rational goal. It is just urging. Gravity is will. Magnetism is will. Animal instinct is will. It is all the exact same blind force pushing through different masks.
Which brings us to the segment I have been a little bit dreading, but also kind of fascinating, the dark side of all this.
Yeah.
Because if the universe is just a blind urge, what does that mean for us humans actually living in it?
It leads to a very profound pessimism. Schopenhauer is famous for looking at all this and saying this is the worst of all possible worlds.
Talk about a buzzkill. I mean, why the worst? There's ice cream and sunsets and good things.
Because of the actual mechanics of how will operates?
Yeah.
Think about it. To will something means you lack it. If you want food, it is because you are hungry. Hunger is essentially a form of pain. So as long as you are willing, you are suffering from a lack of something.
Okay, but what if I get what I want? Like, what if I eat the ice cream?
Then the will stops for a brief moment.
Yeah.
But because the will is your very essence, when it stops, you just feel empty. You are bored.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that is the cycle. Pain or boredom. We are permanently trapped in this pendulum swing. We strive, we suffer, we achieve, we get bored, and then we strive again.
Dr. Holmes mentions in the source material that this philosophy had a huge impact on the existentialists later on, people like Sartre and Camus.
Absolutely, it did. Think of Camus and the myth of Sisyphus pushing the rock up the hill forever only to watch it roll right back down. That is Schopenhauer's universe in a nutshell. There was even a follower mentioned in the lecture, Edward von Hartmann, who took this to its ultimate logical extreme.
The guy with the extremely grim solution.
Very grim. Von Hartmann argued that if existence is just blind, pointless striving, and if human consciousness is really just the universe waking up to realize how completely miserable it is, then the most rational act is for humanity to collectively commit suicide, just to extinguish the will once and for all.
That is incredibly heavy, just bleak. But Dr. Holmes did mention there are escapes, right? Schopenhauer doesn't just leave us in the pit with no way out. He offers a ladder.
He offers three ladders, actually, but they are mostly temporary fixes. The first one is aesthetics, art.
Ah, so like losing yourself in a painting or a really good song.
Right. When you contemplate art, you stop wanting for a moment. You're just observing the idea. You step off the treadmill of the will entirely. You become a pure knower. But of course, you can't live your whole life in an art gallery.
True. You eventually have to leave. And the second ladder?
Ethics. Specifically, sympathy. When you realize that you and I and the dog and the tree are all the exact same will, and that individuality is just an illusion created by the mask, you stop being so selfish. You merge your will with the absolute. You feel deep compassion because you realize the suffering is universal.
That actually sounds a bit like Buddhism.
It is deeply influenced by Eastern thought.
Mm-hmm.
Schopenhauer was actually one of the first major Western philosophers to really read the Upanishads and Buddhist texts. And his third solution is even more Eastern. Asceticism.
Which is what exactly in this context?
Total negation of the will. You repress desire entirely. You actively starve the impulse. It is the path of the saint or the ascetic monk who completely denies the self.
But wait, if the world is a projection of my will and I manage to completely turn off my will, doesn't the world just disappear?
Precisely. You enter a state of absolute nothingness. For Schopenhauer, that nothingness, that sort of nirvana, is infinitely better than the suffering of existence.
Wow. Okay. I think we all need a little bit of a breather from the abyss right now. Let's pivot. Because Dr. Holmes takes us from this incredibly dark, monistic, German pessimism to something completely different. American personal idealism.
Yes. Let's hop across the ocean to the sunny campuses of USC and Boston University in the early 20th century. It is a totally different vibe over there.
Who are the key players we are looking at here?
You mainly have Borden Parker Bound. Fun fact, the philosophy building at USC is actually named after him. And then you have Edgar Sheffield Brightman over at Boston University.
And they are looking at the exact same problem, reality and the self, but they are coming to a totally different conclusion.
Correct. Remember Schopenhauer's a monadist? He thought there's only one giant will, and we are just tiny temporary ripples in it. The personal idealists are pluralists.
So instead of one giant blob of will, reality is a society.
Exactly. Reality is defined by personhood. They argue that the most real thing we know isn't a blind physical force. It is consciousness. It is personality. So reality itself is a society of persons. God is the supreme person, and we are finite persons interacting with him.
I can definitely see why this view was super popular in America, especially with religious thinkers.
Oh, it was incredibly influential for Christian philosophers and evangelicals in the 1940s and 50s, because it allowed them to keep the idea of a personal God and individual identity intact. You don't just get absorbed into the blob. You matter as a distinct individual person.
But there is a catch here. If reality is a society of persons presided over by a personal God, we run face first into a classic problem.
The problem of evil.
Right, because if God is a person and God is good, why do terrible things happen? Schopenhauer had a really easy answer for that. The universe is blind and it just doesn't care. But personal idealism actually has to answer for the suffering.
And Edgar Sheffield Brightman offers a radical solution that I honestly find fascinating because it completely challenges the traditional view of God.
Yeah.
He looks at the traditional definition, which says God is altogether good, altogether wise, and altogether powerful.
And then he looks at the world and sees what he calls purposeless evil.
He calls it the disteleological surd.
Okay, we definitely have to unpack that phrase. Disteleological surd.
It is a mouthful for sure. Teleology means purpose. So disteleological means purposeless. And a surd is actually a mathematical term for an irrational number, something that just doesn't fit neatly into the equation.
So he is talking about things like natural disasters or cancer in children, things that really don't seem to build character or teach us grand moral lessons. They are just tragic.
Exactly. Brightman argues you cannot logically hold all four of those points at the same time. You can't have God be entirely good, wise, powerful, and still have the existence of these surds. The logic simply breaks down. One of them has to go.
And I feel like most people would drop the good part, like saying God is just beyond our human morality, or they say we just don't understand the mysterious plan.
But Brightman absolutely refuses to compromise God's goodness. He says if God is not good, he is not God, period. So instead, he drops altogether powerful.
Whoa. Yeah. So he is saying God isn't omnipotent.
Not in the traditional sense, no. This concept is called theistic finitism. Brightman suggests that within God's own nature, there is a given, a passive irrational element, a chaotic surd that God did not create and cannot fully delete.
So God is basically struggling.
Yes. God is infinite in goodness and infinite in love, but finite in power. He is constantly working to master this irrational element to bring order out of the internal chaos. So when an earthquake happens, it is not because God wanted it or allowed it to teach us some tough lesson. It is because the given that irrational element basically slipped the leash.
That drastically changes how you view the divine. it makes God seem honestly far more relatable, like a cosmic partner who is struggling alongside us against the chaos.
It really does. It solves the logical problem of evil by just flat out admitting God has limits. It frames the universe not as a finished, pristine kingdom where everything is preordained, but as an ongoing battle that God is actively fighting with us.
It is fascinating how we started today with Schopenhauer saying the core of reality is a blind, struggling will, and we end up with personal idealism saying the core of reality is a person struggling against chaos.
The struggle remains completely central in both views, doesn't it? But the nature of the struggle changes from a pointless repetition to a meaningful moral battle for order.
Before we wrap things up, Dr. Holmes gives us sort of a grocery list of other idealists around the world. We obviously can't dive deep into all of them today, but it really shows this wasn't just a localized German or American thing.
Not at all. It was a global mood at the time.
Mm.
Philosophers everywhere were rejecting materialism. In France, you had thinkers like Mendebiren emphasizing feeling over logic, and Maurice Blondel focusing on Christian action.
Mm.
In Italy, you had Giovanni Gentile, who serves as a bit of a cautionary tale.
How so?
Well, he took Hegelian idealism, specifically the idea of the state as the ultimate expression of spirit, and he became the main political theorist for fascism.
Oh, wow. So this whole projecting onto reality idea can go very, very wrong.
Absolutely. If you project a desire for total control, yes, it goes dark quickly. Meanwhile, in Britain, you had thinkers like F.H. Bradley and A.E. Taylor trying to mix Hegel with moral arguments for God. And back in the U.S., you had Josiah Royce at Harvard, who talked extensively about the beloved community.
And all of them are basically trying to answer that exact same question. When we project our human spirit onto the cosmos, what comes back at us?
Exactly. They're all looking in that same mirror.
So bringing it all together, what does this all mean for you listening today? We have gone from the terrifying blind will of Schopenhauer to the finite, struggling God of Brightman.
I think the deep relevance lies in that very act of projection. Schopenhauer challenged us to realize that we never see the world purely objectively. We see it through our physical needs, our bodies, our wills.
And personal idealism challenges us to decide if we are alone in that projection or if we are actually part of a much larger community.
Exactly. Are we distinct persons in a meaningful relationship with the cosmos? Or are we just temporary bubbles in a boiling pot of blind energy?
And here's where it gets really interesting, Fanny. If Schopenhauer is right, and the world is my idea, meaning if I am projecting my inner nature onto the universe,
go on.
Then what does our current view of the world say about us?
That is the perfect provocative thought to end on.
Think about it for a second. Look at how you describe the world today. When you watch the news or look at your neighborhood, do you see it as a dog-eat-dog chaotic mess? Do you see it as a rigid, unfeeling machine? Or do you see it as a web of meaningful relationships?
Because if this philosophy holds any weight, you aren't really describing the world out there. You are describing yourself.
You are holding up a mirror. And the real question is, what exactly is looking back?
Indeed.
Yeah.
Something to chew on.
Thanks for taking this deep dive with us. We will see you in the next one.